Chapter 20. I find being in Los Angeles for any longer than a few days rather painful. I have felt that way about the place since my first visit about 34 years ago. Although there are lovely areas, some wonderful restaurants, and close friends and family members whom I love dearly, it just ain't for me. I don't care for the consistent sunshine, the lack of rain, the absence of seasons, and the sprawl of it all. 4 years ago, I found myself there after an absence of more than 5 years, filming a limited series called Feud. I flew back and forth a number of times from L.A. to London so as not to be away for too long at any one time, but often had to stay longer than I had hoped due to the schedule. The pain of being away from my family was, of course, palpable, but more palpable was a shooting pain in my jaw. The pain had been coming and going for a while, but when I was in L.A. it worsened. I found a wonderful dentist who couldn't quite discern what was wrong, but told me to come back and check with her if it persisted. I flew back to London and had a wisdom tooth removed at the request of my dentist there, as we both thought it was too close to the adjacent tooth and food was getting trapped in between and causing the issue. I know that's a gross image in any book, let alone a food memoir, and I apologize. Yet after the removal, the pain got worse. Back in L.A., I returned to the first dentist, who examined me and suggested that it might be a form of oral cancer. I was stunned to the point of almost fainting. Kate had died after a horrid 4-year struggle with cancer, and the thought of revisiting that world again was something I dreaded. The dentist suggested I get a scan right away. I was leaving that evening and decided I would have it done in the U.K. Partly out of fear and partly out of a profoundly arrogant disbelief that I could ever get cancer, I delayed the appointment. The pain continued for a while and, in fact, began to increase. This started me on a steady diet of ibuprofen. Over the coming months, as the pain increased, along with my intake of ibuprofen, I continued to work, but it was getting harder and harder to function. I returned to London after working in Toronto before Christmas 2017 in more pain than ever. Felicity insisted I visit a doctor in London who specialized in cancer of the salivary gland. Within 10 seconds of prying my mouth open with a gloved hand and looking down my throat, he said, "You have a huge tumor at the base of your tongue. It is most likely cancerous, and this is what you're going to do. You're going to have a scan. The scan will most likely show that you have cancer and whether it has metastasized. Then they will perform surgery to remove it if they can. Then you will have radiation and chemotherapy, and most likely you will have to eat through a feeding tube in your stomach for some months." He had no bedside manner, to say the least. I almost fainted again. In the hope of finding a cure for Kate, we had traveled around the world and met a number of doctors and scientists, some traditional, some alternative, who had dedicated themselves to finding a cure for what Siddhartha Mukherjee calls the emperor of all maladies. So I had come to learn about cancer from many different perspectives, and that knowledge had made me at once hopeful and very fearful. Because Kate's experience with the standard of care, chemotherapy, radiation, etc., had been so horrible and ultimately futile, I was determined not to go through any of it. The problem was that the tumor was so large, surgery was not possible because it would have required removing a large section of my tongue, ensuring that I would never be able to eat or speak normally again. Therefore, the only viable option was 35 days of high-dose targeted radiation, and 7 sessions of low-dose chemotherapy. Luckily, because the cancer had miraculously not metastasized, it had been proven that following this protocol meant the cure rate was close to 90% with an extremely low rate of recurrence. Those were very hard figures to argue with, so in the end, I did go through with it, because I had to. I was, of course, terrified. And although she was such a proactive and positive force, I knew that Felicity was as well. And rightly so. She was pregnant, we were soon to move into a new home, we had a 2-year-old, and 3 children in high school. Yet her innate fortitude, determination, and intelligence to doggedly calculate the best way forward and find the most accomplished avant-garde team of doctors whose treatments would assure a successful outcome eclipsed any fears she may have had. Her reassurance, love, and patience were my greatest pillar of strength, and are still to this day in all things medical and otherwise. What a shame she doesn't feel the same about me. At Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, the head of the department, Dr. Eric Gendon, laid out the initial course of treatment, and Dr. Richard Baxt took over my case from there. Upon meeting him, it was evident that Dr. Baxt had been given an extra dose of bedside manner upon his graduation from medical school. But no matter how kind and reassuring he and his team were, my greatest fear was that one of the most important and vital parts of my life would, or could be, severely compromised, perhaps permanently. That important and vital part being the ability to taste, eat, and enjoy food. How could they possibly expect me to willingly lose my sense of taste and smell and suffer the indignity of having to be fed through a tube in my stomach, the latter of which I was still determined to never be subjected to? They listened patiently as I expressed this fear over and over again in the form of countless questions, to which they always answered that yes, indeed it would be hard going, and I would suffer the loss of my sense of taste and smell as well as most of my saliva, but it was more than likely I would make a full recovery in time. I didn't believe them, but I did, except for when I didn't. The treatment. In order to undergo targeted radiation of the neck or head successfully, the patient's head must be completely still. 5 days a week, for 7 weeks, a bespoke webbed mask would be placed over my face, my neck, and the upper part of my shoulders, and then pinned to a board to completely immobilize my head during the sessions. A bite block was then inserted through a hole in the mask and clenched between my teeth to keep my mouth and tongue also as still as possible. I was beginning to realize that, for better or for worse, most major influences in my life come through this orifice. After 3 treatments, I developed labyrinthitis, a condition from which I had occasionally suffered in the past. It is an extreme form of vertigo causing horrible nausea and the inability to do anything but lie down until it passes. Unfortunately, it also caused me to completely lose my appetite, just as the radiation was beginning to very quickly take its toll on my taste buds, my salivary glands, and the flora and soft tissue of my mouth. After a week of treatments, anything I was capable of putting into my mouth tasted like old wet cardboard. A few days later, everything tasted like the same old wet cardboard, but slathered with someone's excrement. A constellation of ulcers erupted in my mouth, as did viscous, wretched-tasting saliva. From this point on, day after day, all of the above just got worse and worse. The smell of any kind of food was repellent to me because it didn't smell like what it really smelled like. Only the worst components of food were what I smelled or tasted, if I even dared put anything in my mouth at this point. My inability to eat anything save a few sips of beef or chicken broth continued. I made attempts to find something in the fridge to eat, but even upon opening the door, I was confronted with odors most foul. As I said, I could only smell the worst components of any given food. Therefore, each of those components in every carrot, carton of milk, orange, and leftover roasted chicken sitting innocently in the fridge coalesced into a fetid wall of stink. I tried a few more times, but soon ceased visiting the fridge and finally the kitchen itself entirely. If Felicity, who was very pregnant at this point, but as strong as ever, entered the bedroom where I lay in a profound state of nausea, unable to even read, and if she had just eaten or had been cooking something, the odors that clung to her were so powerfully repellent to me that I would ask her to stand at a distance for fear of vomiting all over her. I was given protein drinks, but could barely get them down. The morphine I was given to dull the pain and help me sleep caused such dreadful constipation that at one point I thought it might only be relieved by the use of a mini pipe bomb. The irony was that while I was getting my chemo treatments once a week or getting intravenous fluids to hydrate me a few times a week in the hospital, I watched cooking shows. As they say or tweet, WTF. This was an act of pure masochism, as even just the thought of food disgusted me. In hindsight, I suppose it was a way to cling to what I loved or remember what I'd once had because I was so desperate to have it again. I was determined to make myself heal faster than any patient ever had. I would regain all my sense of taste and saliva sooner rather than later, no matter what the doctors or statistics said, by watching MasterChef, Giada De Laurentiis, Iron Chef, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, and that gross, unnecessary show with the guy who eats as much of something as possible for no apparent reason and yet somehow still remains alive, because they were the fuel that was going to get me there. Somewhere in the middle of treatments, actually on April 19th, Felicity gave birth to Amelia. She was born by cesarean, which, as we know, is easiest on the baby, and not so great for the mother for quite a while afterward. Although vaginal birth isn't exactly a thrilling experience either. Let's face it. If men had to give birth, there would probably be only a total of about 47 people living on the face of the earth today, as opposed to billions. And abortion clinics would just be another department in Walmart alongside auto parts, golf gear, and firearms. Luckily, I was strong enough to be present at the birth to see Felicity and our sweet issue afterward, but I soon had to disappear into my bed again. I kept thinking I would regain my strength enough to hold Amelia and help Felicity, but by the fifth week, I was so weak, was so nauseous, and had lost so much weight, I practically begged to have a feeding tube implanted in my stomach. That tube was to remain in me for almost 6 months. By the time my treatment had ended, I had lost 30 pounds, about 2 stone, had lost all of my facial and neck hair, and could barely walk up a flight of stairs. Upon our return to London, I had to stay in bed all day and feed myself through the tube, with either protein shakes or, eventually, food of my own making. I had missed cooking so much that I would struggle through the smell of the ingredients just to be able to stand at the stove and create something I knew I could eat. What it tasted like didn't matter, as it was going directly into my stomach by way of the tube. But it was important to me that if someone else were to eat it by mouth, they would find it appetizing. I would puree beans and chicken stock with some pasta or even egg-fried rice, but had to thin it all quite a bit with water or more stock so it wouldn't clog up the tube. The tube was also the way I hydrated myself, as I could not even drink water by mouth because it burned like battery acid. When confronted with my weakened condition, my older children, Niccolo, Isabel, and Camilla, were very positive and encouraging. However, I knew how hard it was for them to see me so ill when, not even a decade before, their mother had suffered similarly. It was evident that my being diagnosed with cancer really frightened them, but Felicity and I reassured them that mine was a very different prognosis than Kate's. However, the trauma of losing a parent never fully disappears. Only the parent does. I knew that no matter how much reassurance we offered, part of them feared that they would have to experience that trauma all over again. Week after week, month after month, as Mateo's height and vocabulary grew, Amelia began to sleep through the night and learn to crawl. Nico and Isabel applied to universities and graduated high school. Camilla approached her junior year. We somehow moved into our new home. Felicity healed from her surgery. I slowly started to get better. However, I will admit that it was a much longer and more difficult recovery than I'd anticipated. I had suffered from depression during treatment, and even after treatment, my depression continued for months. There were so many days when being confined to my bed, listening to my family go about their lives downstairs while I was unable to participate in any way, made me feel like a ghost in my own home. There were times when I believed I would never, ever be able to cook or enjoy a meal again with the people I love. 6 months after my last treatment, I flew to New York City for a scan and stayed with our friends Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively. If you thought the name-dropping was over, I'm sorry to break your rice bowl. I wanted to go to the scan alone, but Ryan insisted on coming with me. He's the only pushy Canadian I know. The team of doctors gathered around with the results of that morning's scan, which showed no evidence of disease, now my favorite 4 words in any language. Needless to say, I was greatly relieved. Ryan had tears in his eyes, as did the female doctors, but I know it was only because they were in such close proximity to him. The doctors all agreed that I could finally remove the feeding tube from my torso, and I was thrilled. A balloon filled with water keeps the tube from slipping out of you and onto the floor, and to remove it, one simply drains the balloon, grabs onto the tube, and gives a good yank, which I was told would feel like a punch in the gut, and that's that. I asked if we could do it then and there instead of waiting for the doctor who had inserted it. The mood was buoyant because of the good news and the presence of Mr. Reynolds in the room, so Dr. Bax gave the go-ahead for the indecorous appendage to be removed. One of the female doctors, who, like the rest of the staff, including the men, had been in a constant blush since Deadpool himself had entered, said she would do the honors. Still in the amorous delirium of the starstruck, she grabbed the tube and was about to yank it from my wizened torso when I cried, "Wait!" "What?" she asked, looking at me slightly annoyed because I had spoiled her big moment in front of you-know-who. "Don't you want to deflate the balloon first?" The balloon inside me. You have to, otherwise it won't fit through the... Oh, right, right. Yes, of course. Sorry, it's been a while since I've done it. Amid much laughter, she carried out the procedure properly, and I was finally free of what had been my second mouth for too long. Once that tube was removed, I felt a profound sense of freedom. Now I had no other way of eating except through the orifice specifically designed for that purpose. Although I had already begun to eat by mouth, my diet was limited to only soft, mild foods. This was frustrating, but I knew I had been incredibly lucky not to have lost the ability to swallow properly and move my tongue in a normal fashion, two side effects that are very common even without surgery, because the radiation can cause significant damage to the muscles necessary for both actions. Speech therapists are part of post-treatment programs to teach recovering patients specific exercises to help them regain mobility in their tongue and jaw. Luckily, 4 years of speech and vocal training made me hyper-aware of what was happening, and I was therefore able to do what was necessary to maintain normal movement along the way. For over 2 years, my mouth was incredibly sensitive. I couldn't drink anything carbonated and certainly could not eat anything spicy. I was able to drink and taste alcohol, but mostly stuck to white wine with copious amounts of ice. Red wine also had to be iced, as the tannins made it feel like someone had taken a cloth sprinkled with dust and pepper and dragged it across my tongue. My beloved martinis were a sad struggle. Steak was impossible because the lack of saliva makes one unable to break down meat enough to swallow it, and therefore the whole bite turns into a bolus that is very easily choked on. I had a few close calls attempting to eat something as benign as a chicken breast. The same was true for most flesh and thick pieces of bread. Whatever I ate had to contain a certain amount of moisture in or around it. Otherwise, it took quite a while to get it down my throat, or I just couldn't eat it at all. It is fascinating how perfectly balanced the human body is. A little less saliva and the number of foods one can swallow drops precipitously. When I'd see my family members casually grab a piece of bread or a cracker, a piece of smoked salmon, or a few pieces of salami to slap into a baguette and wolf it down without a thought, I was so envious. For everything that entered my mouth, I'd have to calculate what I'd need to augment it with in order to swallow it without choking. Not unlike my father, I used to eat far too quickly. As a kid, I would have finished my second dish of pasta when my sisters had barely finished their first. This bad habit disappeared out of necessity. I also could not casually chat to someone across the table while eating. For the most part, I had to finish the task at hand and then have a conversation. Even when I was able to once again go to restaurants, have people over for a meal, or go to someone else's home for dinner, I was filled with anxiety because I didn't know what I'd be able to eat. I was afraid I would choke on something or eat something spicy by mistake and then not be able to eat for the rest of the night because my mouth would be in so much pain. If someone would ask me to taste something, whether it was a friend, a restaurant owner, or a chef, I would try a bite just out of politeness and fake that I could either taste it or swallow it, or that I wasn't in agony. They could not understand or conceive of the fact that something so delicious might taste like shit to me, or that even gentle spices might damage my mouth for the next 24 hours, or, for that matter, comprehend what it's like to eat anything having basically no saliva. Even at home, I often found myself eating separately from my family because I was embarrassed about how hard it was for me to get through a simple bowl of pasta. All of this was frustrating and anathema to the way I had lived my life ever since childhood. How I socialized was primarily through eating and drinking. Although each week there was some progress, I could not help but feel that things would never return to the way they were, when life was edible. As I said, for almost 2 years, with the exception of stocks and broths, I ate a primarily vegetarian diet. The following dish was a staple, as it was easy to swallow and basically contained all the nutrients I needed to keep myself healthy. I can honestly say that after all this time, I am still not sick of it because it's really delicious. This recipe, along with scrambled eggs, oatmeal, and various soups, basically kept me going and helped rebuild my strength. Pasta fagioli. My way. Serves 4. Extra virgin olive oil. 1 medium onion, sliced. 2 garlic cloves, halved. Half bunch cavolo nero, roughly chopped. 3 14-ounce cans cannellini beans. 3 cups chicken stock. or vegetable stock. 2 to 3 cups marinara sauce. 1 pound small pasta, like ditali or gnocchetti sardi. Salt. Fresh ground black pepper. Parmigiano Reggiano or pecorino for serving. Optional. Pour a glug of the oil into a medium pot and sauté the onion and garlic over medium-low heat until soft. At the same time, boil the cavolo nero in a small pot of salted water. Add the beans, stock, and marinara to the pan with the onion and garlic and stir together. Cook over low heat. When the cavolo nero is soft, strain it, add it to the bean mixture, and stir. Continue to cook on a low simmer with a lid askew for about 15 minutes. In the meantime, boil the pasta in salted water according to the directions on the package. When it's done, strain it, reserving about a cup of the water, and place it in a large bowl. Add about 2 cups of the bean mixture to the pasta, along with some of the pasta water, and a drizzle of oil, and mix. Salt to taste, and divide among 4 bowls. Add more bean mixture to each bowl, along with a drizzle of oil. Sprinkle with pepper and Parmigiano or pecorino, if using. Variation. Loosely scramble 2 large eggs in a pan with olive oil. Then add 1 portion of the finished recipe above, including the pasta, and toss together. Finish with grated Parmigiano or pecorino and a drizzle of olive oil. There have been 2 rather strange beneficial effects from the radiation treatments, neither of which I anticipated. 1 is an increased metabolism. I already had a very fast metabolism, yet now mine could keep pace with that of my 18-year-old self. The other is that any food allergies I had, such as intolerance to dairy, sugar, and at times gluten, have basically disappeared. I have been told that because I didn't really eat for so long, my system reset, as it were. It's like when people are told by dietitians to cut out certain foods to see if they might be the cause of some gastrointestinal issue, then slowly reintroduce those foods sometime in the future, and the stomach will sometimes be able to accept them. That has happened in spades to me. I can eat basically everything now. My digestion has never been better, and I've finally put on about 15 pounds. I've chosen to write about this painfully ironic experience because my illness and the brutal side effects of the treatment caused me to realize that food was not just a huge part of my life. It basically was my life. Food at once grounded me and took me to other places. It comforted me and challenged me. It was part of the fabric that made up my creative self and my domestic self. It allowed me to express my love for the people I love and make connections with new people I might come to love. When I was traveling, it kept me in touch with my family wherever I was in the world, whether on holiday or cooking for myself and a few colleagues while filming on location. During such meals, I would explain that the recipes I'd prepared had been passed down through many generations. These humble dishes had traveled from Calabria to the U.S., to London, and now, to give one example, on location with me to a small bungalow in England's Lake District, where they nourished a whole new set of people who had just entered my life. Watching my guests enjoy the meal I'd made filled me with great familial pride. In those moments, it was clear to me that someday, when my parents are no longer alive, I will always be able to put their teachings and all the love they gave me into a bowl and present it to someone who, sadly, will never have had the good fortune of knowing them. But by eating that food, they will come to know them, if even just a little. Until I began to fathom my deep emotional connections with food, I had always thought that the ceremonial eating of the communion wafer, a symbol for the body of Christ, was a strange, almost barbaric pagan ritual. However, now, it may well be the only aspect of Catholicism that makes any sense to me at all. If you love someone, you just want them inside of you. I know what you're thinking, but let it go. How many parents hug and kiss their kids and say, "I love you so much, I just want to eat you up"? Love can and does enter through the mouth. I must admit that years ago, I never thought that my passion and interest in food would come close to eclipsing how I felt about my chosen profession. Acting, directing, cinema, and the theater had always defined me. But after my diagnosis, I discovered that eating, drinking, the kitchen, and the table now play those roles. Food not only feeds me, it enriches me, all of me, mind, body, and soul. It is nothing more than everything. Cook, smell, taste, eat. drink, share. Repeat as necessary. For better or for worse, those actions are now the definition of the person who is writing this. Were I not able to perform them, I would cease to exist. In Letters to a Young Poet, Rainer Maria Rilke tells a soldier who aspires to be a poet and has sought Rilke's advice that, and I paraphrase, only if he feels like he would die were he unable to write, should he be a poet. That made perfect sense to me 40 years ago when I first read it, and it makes even more sense to me today. As I write this, I can once again cook and enjoy meals with my family and friends. And although I cannot get through an entire T-bone steak, there is quite a bit I can eat, such as sole meuniere and tortellini con panna, risotto, pancakes, salami, slowly, pasta alla carbonara, shrimp fried rice, dim sum, a thin piece of toasted homemade bread with butter and jam, fresh squeezed orange juice, tomato juice, young pecorino cheese, honey, paella, Tuscan fish stew, asparagus, roasted peppers, Italian tuna fish packed in oil, fresh tomato salad with cucumbers and basil, gazpacho, scrambled eggs with smoked salmon, feta, and cucumbers wrapped in a warm tortilla, chili con carne, extremely mild, udon or soba noodles and broth, sheep or cow milk ricotta, tuna melts, razor clams, mussels, oysters, clams on the half shell, goat cheese, langoustine, pasta bolognese, Swiss chard, Felicity's roast potatoes, slowly and with lots of gravy, blueberries, pears, pizza, zucchini, eggplant parmigiana, anchovies, not too salty, pâté, olives, baked camembert, minestrone, pasta con piselli, lasagna, not too cheesy, fresh peas, green beans, sautéed mushrooms, blueberry pie, baked beans, baked sea bass, lobster, mostly the claws with a lot of melted butter, tart tatin, bouillabaisse, rabbit stew, beef stew, banana splits, cheese toasties, potato and leek soup, pasta alla matriciana, not spicy, orecchietti with sausage and broccoli di rapa, slowly, chicken soup with matzo balls, caviar and bellinis, if someone else has bought the caviar, a fried egg on a very thin toasted bagel, pasta con pesto, mashed potatoes, baked salmon, butternut squash soup, any kind of ravioli, cappelletti in brodo, mortadella and prosciutto, slowly, gelato, espresso, and so on and so on and so on. But the most important thing is, I can finally taste it all. All of it. All of that food. Glorious food.